Governor Branstad just announced Iowa's ninth sister state relationship. It's Kosovo in southeastern Europe, a state Iowa has maintained a unique partnership with over the years. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll talk with Major Mike One and Sergeant Major David Enright of the Iowa National Guard. They've spent time in Kosovo and will tell us about the region. We'll also explore some of Iowa's other sister state relations. But first, a new poll shows we Iowans think our children are in more danger of being abducted than in decades past. We'll see if that thinking matches reality. This news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Do you think children in Iowa are in more danger of being abducted than in decades past? If you do, you have a lot of company. And that's according to a new Des Moines Register Iowa poll. 68% of us, of Iowa adults, believe they were safer, that we were safer from the threat of abduction when we were young than Iowa children are today. 25% say children are safer today. 7% aren't sure. The poll was conducted June 2nd through the 5th, and if you remember, this was the time when authorities were searching for 15-year-old Kathleen Shepherd of Dayton, Iowa. She was abducted with a friend after getting off a school bus. The friend escaped, but Kathleen's body was found 18 days later. This poll also comes less than a year after two young cousins disappeared while riding bikes in Evansdale. Hunters found their bodies in December. Joining me now, Gerard Myers is with us, Assistant Director of Field Operations at the Iowa Department of Public Safety, joining us by phone. Thank you for joining us, Gerard.
Ben, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. We've given you short notice to join us, and as I realize we caught you at a time when you don't have all the statistics at hand, but what can you tell us when you hear about this perception that 68% of Iowa adults believe they were safer from the threat of abduction than when they were young than Iowa children today? Does that match reality?
My response would be, Ben, that it does. In fact, I think that that may be a perception that is not only here across the state of Iowa through that poll, but also to some degree nationally. There's certainly a sensation within the public sentiment that we're at a greater risk today than we were when some of us were growing up, and that some of the community awareness and some of the vigilance has either dissipated or that we're at a greater degree of risk.
Mm-hmm. So These tragedies come also as reminders for us to keep vigilant, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. I mean, when we look at overall trending in terms of these types of incidents, they don't happen any more frequently this year than they have in years past. However, when we have a couple paramount cases like we've had here in Iowa, it serves as a reminder for a greater degree of vigilance. And as we enter into the summer months in particular, we highly recommend that the parents and caregivers, guardians, et cetera, have a greater vigilance and are more proactive with regards to their children, partly based upon the fact that their routine changes. They're not in school. They may
right.
be provided by a different caregiver. They may have other camps and activities. And so it serves as an opportunity this time of the year in particular to be more vigilant and communicate what the changing or ever-changing routine might be for kids across.
Well, let's get to that a little bit, because I don't know what year you were built in, Gerard, but in the year I was running around as a youngster in Cedar Falls, like many Iowa communities across the state, in the summer was just, you're outdoors almost the whole day. You perhaps came home for lunch or dinner, unless you found it somewhere else. And so that's the way most families operated. But now we have a higher standard for parents to meet.
Oh, without question, Ben. And, you know, I grew up on the East Coast in the city of Boston, which was a larger metropolitan area, and we operated the same way in the neighborhood. And parents looked after one another's children, and we were very active. And again, back then, it wasn't typical to have both parents in the workplace. So there's been some changes in that particular demographic with regards to professional pursuit. But I have been in Iowa for 17 years and have a great familiarity and and enjoy the small town flavor. And unfortunately, we've had incidents here in the last 12 months that have struck in smaller communities. And I think that just brings to light an opportunity for greater awareness and, again, a heightened vigilance. But overall, from a practical standpoint, the statistics and trending that we see is pretty level. But that's not to say that the public sentiment isn't increased based on these types of tragedies. Not only here, but you look out in Cleveland, Ohio, where there was children that were kidnapped, where the recovery came many years later. And so we've not lost track of Adam Walsh, I guess, in the enforcement arena, and we're constantly trying to increase and continue to persevere through these different strategies for investigative pursuits when faced with these types of incidents here in our neighborhood.
Gerard, can you give us parents out there some specific tips, even if they are reminders, things that we should know, remind us of what we as parents should be thinking about, good practices, and perhaps the do's and don'ts we need to communicate to our kids?
Yeah, these are messages that most of your audience, listening audience, have probably heard before, but some are worth re-noting or rehashing. First of all, the stranger danger tips, not to speak with strangers. I read an article recently out of, I think, the state of Minnesota, where the parents had evaluated a password type of a protocol, where they wouldn't go with anybody without the password, the family password. So stranger danger is big, and in small communities, when neighbors are willing to step in and help one another, we still have to be mindful that the children have to be authorized or have this parental authorization to go with those parties. The other thing, obviously, is the communications on knowing where your children are going, where the destination is, and when their arrival time should be. So that can be monitored, obviously, with some teenagers and cell phone. Parents are doing a lot of communication through that means and that media and through text messaging. And certainly that serves well. We also have to recognize that, we're not always certain who's on the other end of that that mobile device. So to be very conscious and very vigilant about where children are going, where they're supposed to be, and continue the messaging on stranger danger, continue the messaging on Internet safety in particular. We kind of pushed that for the last few years that there's a lot of children that are engaged with online personas and relationships, and parents have to be vigilant to that, too, because we've had our share of cases in which children have been accosted based on an online relationship. So that's just a few of kind of the new technology recommendations and some of the old school protocols with regards to general safety within the community.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned cell phones. Of course, that's the huge difference between now and previous generations. A lot of parents use cell phones as a way to check on kids, text them, to find their location and their well-being. But what I hear, too, is perhaps we could get a false sense of security from that, too, over-reliance.
Absolutely, because I think it's taken out, even in my own personal endeavors, it's taken out a great deal of contact with the other juveniles' parents, for example. When you hear from the child that they've arrived at the friend's house, you take that to be factual and valid, and you have no communication with the other parents. So we continue to recommend a greater degree of parental contact and communications. Not that in any way those devices haven't benefited the overall safety mechanisms in place, but certainly as a secondary level of precaution.
Let me throw out one statistic to end here from the Des Moines Register article. Though the article states, though people often perceive that the threat of abduction is increasing, crimes against children have not risen significantly in the past 15 years, according to Iowa's Division of Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning. The number of convictions for about a dozen such crimes, including kidnapping, enticing a child, have averaged about 100 a year since 1998. So we'll end with that. Gerard Myers, Assistant Director of Field Operations at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Thank you for those words of safety and those observations.
Thank you, Ben. Have a pleasant afternoon, sir.
You too. Thank you. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, Governor Terry Branstad announced that Iowa is establishing a sister state relationship with the once war-torn country of Kosovo. That's in southeastern Europe. Branstad plans to visit that nation during a trip to Europe in July. The announcement last week coincided with a visit to the Iowa capital by the Prime Minister of Kosovo, and this marks Iowa's ninth sister state relationship. Now, in making the announcement, the governor said Iowa and Kosovo have developed a unique partnership due to more than 700 Iowa National Guard soldiers who have served there on peacekeeping missions going back to 2003. Joining me to tell us a little bit about Kosovo, Major Mike One and Sergeant Major David Enright of the Iowa National Guard. They've spent time in Kosovo during deployments. They are in our Des Moines studio. Major Mike One and Sergeant Major David Enright, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be with you.
Major One, you were in Kosovo as a public affairs officer for the Iowa National Guard. I understand in a peacekeeping operation, your time span there was 2005 to 2006. And Sergeant Major Enright, a little bit later, 2007 to 2008. Let's have you give us a little bit of an overview of what you found during those respective times there and what your specific duties were. Who'd like to go first?
Well, Sergeant Major's looking at me, so I'll take the lead here.
Okay. But,
I was fortunate to spend a year in Kosovo back in 2005. And, coming away from Kosovo and the experience that I had there, probably the biggest impression that I would say is that it's a lot like Iowa. The people, the values, the climate. Obviously, it's a smaller country, but there's a lot of similarities between Iowa and Kosovo. And the time that I spent there, I had the chance to go out and work with a journalist in Kosovo, go out and work with some of the educators and filmmakers and people that were doing things to try to help tell the story about Kosovo. And it was just a great opportunity to meet the people and to get an impression. You know, they've come through a struggle that was very difficult for many of the folks in Kosovo, and they really had a positive outlook following that struggle because the international community came to their aid, and the United States was standing with them. And they were very hopeful and working towards a bright future. So the impression I had of Kosovo is, like I say, the people are tremendous. The other thing about the people that I would say is that they really appreciate, genuinely appreciate, the sacrifice that America, the United States military, and our NATO allies have made in coming to their aid. Back in the late 90s and during the last decade that we've had peacekeeping soldiers on the ground there. And every time that I've gone back, they just do a tremendous job of showing that appreciation.
And to the extent that they've named, streets after Americans as well, haven't they?
Absolutely. They have Bill Clinton Boulevard. There's a statue to President Clinton on one of their main roads there in Pristina, the capital. But they are tremendously grateful for the support that they've received from the United States. And now with this state partnership between Iowa and Kosovo, that gratitude is extended to the Iowans that have served over there and are Iowa citizens that have gotten involved in this program.
Sergeant Major Enright, tell us a little bit about your time there, the work you did, and your impressions.
Well, as you mentioned, I was there October 2007 to July 2008, and we were sent over more as a peacekeeping mission to ensure a safe and secure environment for three of the municipalities there in Kosovo. And we kept freedom of movement so people could get back and forth, get to their daily needs of shopping to and from school as children commuted back and forth from different cities. And really law and order for the Kosovo people. Whether they were Albanian or Serbian that were living there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the ethnic groups. Albanians, almost 90% of the population there, I believe, Sergeant Major Enright. When you were trying to keep law and order, freedom of movement within the country during your time there, 2007 to 2008, what were the threats since the hostilities were long since gone? What were the tensions that you identified and had to deal with?
Well, there were still some Serbian communities, as I mentioned, in Kosovo, and every once in a while there would be, let's say, a Molotov cocktail that ended up hitting a mosque in an Albanian community or some vandalism on an Albanian statue. Mm-hmm. And we were sent out to basically investigate on where this came from. Maybe it was, a Serbian village that came over and knew that there was going to be a memorial service at a cemetery, so they had placed a couple of unexploded ordnance on that cemetery that morning, where we would have to bring in some engineers to clear the area before we could have the Albanian activity happened that day.
Mm-hmm. You're saying about attacks or Molotov cocktails thrown on mosques. The Serbs are Christians, correct? And so we have the Albanians as Muslims, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you met with a number of people, mayors, war veterans, Sergeant Major Enright. How apparent were the scars of the conflict at the time that you both were there? And let's start with you, Sergeant Major Enright.
I primarily worked with the war veterans, and they all fought in the war. They lost family members in the war, and they still remember the battles that were fought. It wasn't that long ago, 1999, when all this was taking place. So when I was there, they still remember. A lot of them were retired from the Army. They were just standing up their army at the time. So a lot of the army were the younger kids, possibly sons and daughters, from the veterans that I was working with. But they did remember the battles that were fought and the soldiers that were lost.
Did they hesitate? Did they talk about it a lot, or is it something they shied away from in conversation?
They would talk about it, and they would try to get the army to take their side on the issues of themselves and the Serbians. And, we were really just there for the safe and secure environment, freedom of movement, and law mm-hmm. and order. So,
okay. Let's go to Major Mike One, because you said you worked with journalists, so you probably had more of the sort of conversations about the context in which your peacekeeping was happening.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that you'll find, and even today when we have the opportunities, we bring members of the Kosovo Security Force, many of whom served in the Kosovo Liberation Army. We bring them over for exchanges, and our soldiers will go over there. And I've had an opportunity to go back to Kosovo a couple of times since I took this position as a state partnership program director. Mm-hmm. And you'll find in visiting with our friends in Kosovo that everybody has a story to tell, and everybody has a story from that era that they're very open about wanting to share the experiences that they went through, whether it was a military experience that they had, or even some of the guys that we work with now, they were children during that time frame, and they'll talk about what happened, as far as a home being burned or having to flee out into the mountains to avoid conflict. And so everybody has a story to tell from that time. But the thing that they share now today, of course, is that there's a lot of pride, particularly on the Albanian side, having come through the experiences of the late 90s, and now they're an independent country and they've seen the progress and they're very proud of that. And, it's a very young country. The average age is approximately 26, 28 years old. And so many of those folks, went through that experience as a young person, and now they're, they survived that and they're looking forward. And I think one of the differences that, from a personal standpoint that I noticed when it was, an Albanian community or a Serbian community, is that the folks from the Albanian side were typically they were looking forward to the future and trying to get past the conflict. And sometimes that was a bit more of a challenge for the folks in the Serbian communities.
Mm-hmm. Did the two groups have different feelings about the United States, about the Western powers?
Yeah, they did. But I would also say that, during the riots of 2004, where many of the Serbian Orthodox churches and some of their religious sites became targets of the riots, the U.S., along with its NATO allies, came to the defense of those facilities to try to stop them from being damaged. And I think there was a lot of gratitude that was expressed by the Serbian communities because they took steps to try to protect those buildings and those institutions that were important to them. And, mm-hmm. and so maybe they weren't pleased with the position that the government had as far as whether Kosovo should become an independent country, but the fact that the peacekeepers did their job to try to maintain the peace on both sides, they had an appreciation for that as well.
I wonder, and certainly you're not necessary to know this. I thought one of you might know the extent, because we hear so little about it in our media these days, the extent of our presence, the NATO presence that's still in the Balkan region.
Yeah, we still have peacekeepers that are on the ground as part of and they're called the Kosovo Force. When I was there, there were approximately 1,600 U.S. peacekeepers that were part of a larger NATO force of I want to say maybe 17,000 at the time. And I think it all started with approximately 40,000 peacekeepers back in 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. And Sergeant Major, I don't know if you recall what
there was
the size 12, of NATO.
1,200 on the ground when I was there, 1,200 mm-hmm. U.S.
And today there's probably less than 600 U.S. out of a NATO force that I want to say is maybe about 6,000 strong.
Now I imagine because we have been dealing with conflicts in other part of the world that you have a different perspective on things going on. Perhaps, well, Sergeant Major Enright, you served in Afghanistan, but we have Afghanistan, we have Iraq, we have Egypt, Syria, where Libya, where there was either intervention or talk of intervention here, and I imagine these. Experiences that you've had color your view of U.S. intervention abroad. What can you say about that, either of you, please?
Yes, sir. Like Major One mentioned earlier, I mean, they, Albanians, Serbians, Afghanistan, they all extended their respect toward Americans. And anything we did to help them out, they definitely showed appreciation toward us helping them out in their country. I can remember on, when Kosovo declared their independence, they all wanted their pictures with us. They were all out in the street, setting off fireworks, having parties, just like we would do in the United States.
Mm-hmm. How did your time in Kosovo change you as a person coming back to Iowa? What did you keep with you that you didn't have before going there?
They really appreciated like our school program that we provided notebooks, pens, pencils. They had little to work with over there in the schools, along with in the wintertime we had a coat and a hat mittens drive where local churches and neighborhoods would send coats and mittens over, and we would just be out on patrol and see kids out there in 20-degree weather with no hat or gloves on and just stop the patrol and hand out coats and mittens to these children. And they really have very little, and you come back here and we have so much.
Come to appreciate what you have, what you grew up with. I don't know. Are you both native Iowans?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now we're going to be talking about sister state relationships, specifically this one. In our next half hour, we have just a very brief time. So how has your time in Kosovo informed the way you're looking at this new sister state relationship? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm probably a little bit closer to it than others because I've been working closely with General Orr and Iowa sister states to try to get this set up. Because we, as part of our state partnership program, we saw the sister state relationship as another great way to extend our hand of friendship to Kosovo, to really extend it beyond the military to military exchanges that we do. And I'll look at this from what General Orr calls a whole of Iowa to the whole of Kosovo. And our friends at Iowa Sister States have just been tremendous and given us the opportunity to work with them to establish that organization and that relationship between Iowa and Kosovo. And, I think it really will provide a framework as we go forward to expand our relationship with Kosovo.
Okay. Sergeant Major David Enright with us, Major Mike One of the Iowa National Guard. Both have spent time in Kosovo. Iowa's establishing a sister state relationship with that once war-torn country. And when we come back, we'll talk with Kim Heidemann, Deputy Director of Iowa Sister States, to talk about this, the newest sister state, and also talk a little bit about the other relationships. I wonder if you can name any other sister states that Iowa has. We'll let you think on that for a little bit and then come back in just a moment. And perhaps you, as a listener, have had some involvement in another sister state relationship. We'd love to hear about it. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, Governor Terry Branstad announced that Iowa is establishing a sister state relationship with the once war-torn country of Kosovo, a nation in southeastern Europe. And in making that announcement, the governor said that Iowa and Kosovo had developed a unique partnership due to more than 700 Iowa National Guard soldiers who have served there on peacekeeping missions since 2003. And joining us in our first half hour, and they're still with us in our Des Moines studio, Sergeant Major David Enright and Major Mike One of the Iowa National Guard both spent time in Kosovo doing various duties. They're telling us a little bit what that our newest sister state is like, their experiences there, and we want to reach out to you this half hour as we continue to talk about not only Kosovo as a sister state of Iowa, but other sister states. Perhaps you have had some involvement in another sister state relationship that Iowa has with a country abroad. If you'd like to join us with a comment or a question or an experience, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us now as well, Kim Heidemann is with us in our Des Moines studio, Deputy Director of Iowa Sister States. Good afternoon to you, Kim.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Tell us a little bit, because Major One and Sergeant Major Enright referred to Iowa Sister States. Tell us a little bit about this organization of which you are the deputy director.
Mm-hmm. Iowa Sister States is a nonprofit, volunteer-driven organization that manages the partnership program the state of Iowa has with eight different countries, soon to be nine. And we work in Yamanashi, Japan, Yucatan, Mexico, Hebei, China, Terengganu, Malaysia, Stavropol, Russia, Taiwan, Cherkasy, Ukraine, and Veneto, Italy.
Okay, so there you have all of those. And also, you have worked with the Iowa National Guard, I understand, to support the work in this state partnership program with Kosovo. What has been the involvement there?
Yeah, I think this started about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, when we were first contacted to just sort of start the conversation on what it's like to work towards a sister state relationship and if this is something that could even be done. So since then, Major One and I have become quite a team, mm-hmm. and we have worked on this for quite a while together.
Mm-hmm. So what is a sister state? Can that mean different things? Do you define it depending on the relationship you have, or does it have to set certain definitions?
In order to become a sister state, you do have to have some support, significant support. In this case, it took 2 years to get to the point where we are now. There's always got to be a volunteer community here in the state that would support this because, again, we are volunteer-driven. Mm-hmm. We have two.
Supported in what way?
That they'll be the home hosts, that they will take them to dinner, that they will participate in making up the schedules. We have volunteer drivers. We only have two staff, and we work in a lot of different areas. And so we rely heavily on our volunteers to be citizen diplomats.
So this has actually a lot to do with face-to-face visits. It's centered more on that than on an ongoing relationship?
I would say both. We want continuity, and we feel that with face-to-face visits, that's how you keep the continuity. Now, that being said, some of our sister states are more active than others because of the fact that we lose our continuity piece in that country. We try our best to get over there because face-to-face is often what cements the relationship, but sometimes due to unforeseen things, we aren't able to keep up the continuity in some of those areas.
Of the list that you named of them, some of them that have kind of the continuity has fallen by the wayside a bit.
Mm-hmm. I would say Terengganu, Malaysia has been a bit difficult. Cherkasy, Ukraine, again, has become a bit difficult, but those are obstacles. We work through them. We've been sister states for several years in some of those areas, in Ukraine since 1996 and in Malaysia since 1987. The volunteers here in Iowa for those particular committees have not left. I mean, they're still just as passionate as they were when the relationship started. So we always try different avenues, different ways. We see if there's a different organization in, for example, Ukraine that might work with us. We just try to do our best to keep them as active as we can.
Sergeant Major Enright and Major Mike One are two of about 700 Iowa National Guard soldiers who have served in Kosovo. Do you expect, Kim Heidemann, that many of the volunteers that you have for now and into the future will be drawn from these ranks because they have that firsthand experience there to remember and to foster?
Well, that is the hope because they have so much to offer. and that they have been there, so they understand the reality, because sometimes our volunteers have the best intentions, but if we haven't actually been there, we don't necessarily understand the perspective. So their firsthand knowledge of that perspective is very, very helpful. And our other volunteers will be drawn from other sectors, education, perhaps healthcare. We have a lot of education people, but then also just our regular volunteers. They're interested. They're very excited by this new relationship.
Let me ask Major One, what do you see in your personal future as far as keeping the Kosovo sister state relationship alive with Iowa?
Well, one thing, Ben, just to kind of add on what Kim was talking about in terms of volunteers, you know, the Iowa National Guard has had a lot of soldiers that have served over there these past 10 years. But what we've found as we've reached out to other folks in Iowa, that the Iowans from across various communities have already been doing things in Kosovo.
Yeah.
An example that I could give you would be Judge Larry Eisenhower from the Iowa Court of Appeals. He spent 6 months in Kosovo back in 2005 as part of a UN rule of law program, and he has been back since as for a visit. One of the volunteers, and so that's a good example from another sector that I'd like to share. And then another volunteer that we have who kind of crosses both lanes here is Dennis Dietz, who's a retired colonel from the Iowa National Guard, a JAG officer who served in Kosovo back in 2004, who has been working with sister states as on the Kosovo committee that has been set up to chair that committee. And he, too, has gone back in his own personal capacity to visit friends and to establish relationships in Kosovo with people that he's worked as. But Iowa State University has been doing things in Kosovo as part of its education program in veterinary medicine, I believe it is. And then also Graceland University down in Lamoni, something we didn't know until about a year ago when we started working with the sister states. They've hosted a number of students from Kosovo down at Graceland University this last decade, and they have a number of graduates that have gone through their program and have gone back to Kosovo and are giving back to their country in various capacities, either in working for a foreign ministry or in other government organizations where they take their education that they received in Iowa and take that back to Kosovo to help build their country.
Well, what can any of you say about the importance of these relationships? Iowans out there hearing about these and saying, oh, well, it's a nice thing to have, perhaps a sister state relationship. But why, when you make the pitch out there, when you reach out for volunteers, why should Iowans care about these specific sister state relationships?
Well, I would say two things. Number one is that it makes Iowans richer. It gives them an opportunity to essentially travel without ever actually leaving Iowa. And so a lot of our people home host because they have young children or high schoolers, and they want to expose them early to somebody from another area and get that different perspective. But also they should care about it because you just never know what's going to happen. I think a great example of that kind of thing is President Xi Jinping. As people are in Iowa are well aware, in 1985, President Xi came to Iowa as a member of an agriculture delegation. He spent 2 weeks crisscrossing Iowa, much the same as he would today if he came on an agriculture delegation from Hebei. And X number of years later, he is talking about the friendship and the hospitality he had in Iowa and how that's going to be a part of future China-American relations. So it can really be something that impacts down the line.
Right. And in fact, we want to pull up a little bit of an interview that we conducted last year, I believe last November, to hear a little bit more about the special relationship, Kim, that you just mentioned between one Iowan and China's new leader, Xi Jinping. A relationship that goes back to the 1980s. Last November, I spoke with a community volunteer in Muscatine, Sarah Landy, a member of a Muscatine delegation that had just returned from China. It was a trip designed to lead to further cultural, educational exchanges, as well as increased business opportunities. And China's new president, Xi Jinping, described her, Sarah Landy of Muscatine, as an old friend. I believe, Kim, you are a new friend, right?
I am. I helped organize that trip on the Iowa side that she took. Yeah.
And let's listen back to this 4 or 5 minutes of conversation here and have you react to that, Kim. I began by asking Sarah Landy how the relationship with Xi Jinping started.
In 1983, the state of Iowa signed a sister state relationship with Hebei province in China, our governor to get their governor. And when you have a sister state relationship, exchanges go back and forth. It so happened that I was on the board of directors of the first Iowa sister state committee, so I'm sort of connected in that way. In 1984, I had gone to China with the Friendship Force led by Governor Ray, past Governor Ray, and his wife, Billy. So therefore, I had a strong interest in China. Well, in 1985, one of the first delegations from our new sister state from China to Iowa was the one led by Xi Jinping. It was an agricultural delegation, and they said they wanted to come to learn how to feed their people better and have a better sense of well-being for the people of their country. And since I was on the board and had previously just been to China, I said, oh, I'd like to bring them to Muscatine. Also, we had the businesses that they were interested in. They wanted to see a farm that raised pigs, and we have a grain processing, Heinz, Monsanto, Kent Feeds. So we had just what they needed, and I wanted to bring some people from China and introduce them to my community.
Mm-hmm. What was it about that 1985 visit? Obviously, Xi Jinping valued it. It was quite a visit that stayed in his memory. That 1985 visit, what do you think made such an impression on him that he would remember it all these years so fondly?
Well, you know, it is a bit amazing to us, but somewhat we think we treated him just with Iowa nice. You know, we gave him hospitality, we had homestay, we were eager to meet people from China. And as remarks that he had made is that this was his first time in America, and it seemed fresh to him. He'd been eager to come here. He had read about the Mississippi River and read Mark Twain. He was eager to see the river. So I think you had two eager people.
Mm.
And a good match. Also, a bit of a background, in 1979, our governor, Bob Ray, went with a group of governors to China and went to Guangdong province where Xi's father was governor. And then his father came to Iowa in 1980 as a return governor's visit with some governors of China. So there was even a little more history of some family back and forth.
And now Xi Jinping, when he returned after that 1985 visit, many years passed. He returned earlier in February of 2012. You met with him. He described you and others in Muscatine as old friends.
Yes.
What did you notice about him? How had he changed? What differences had you seen in him?
You know, he seemed so warm and happy to be there, this smile that wouldn't quit and this handshake. And, you know, it was just sort of electric when he came in the air. When he was here the first time, well, of course, we had one interpreter for four people, and he seemed like a young person that led his delegation well and was curious, asked a lot of questions. But, maybe a little more mature and eager to see old friends.
And eager to ask what questions? What did he want this time to find out about?
Well, I guess eager to see old friends. And it's interesting, he didn't ask too many questions, but he said, you can't imagine the impression you made upon me when I was here before. It feels like I am coming home.
Mm.
And then he said to me, To me, you are America, so wow, you know.
Well, that's quite a pedestal to be put on to represent America.
I know it, and now, you know, we want to do what all things we can to foster good relationships between the U.S. and China.
community volunteer in Muscatine, Sarah Landy, talking with me last year after returning from a trip to China. And Kim Heidemann, when we listen back to the description, you really do get a sense here, don't you, that it's all not sort of mathematics. You can't plan these things. It just happened that there was a series of coincidences that that shows that having sister states really does pay off.
Absolutely. And what Sarah was talking about, too, that Iowa Nice, we hear it time and time again. I've been with sister states for 9 years, and just recently we had a group in March from Ukraine, and they described it that, you know, it changes their life coming here because they are hosted by volunteers. This is a very brand new concept for many people,
right,
that there is a volunteer base that would honestly just open their home for no monetary benefit. That's very different. And then also that they truly are participating in life here. They're not bystanders. They're not going to a hotel later after dinner. They're truly living in someone's home for 10 days, going to children's basketball games. They go to the grocery store together. They participate in volunteer activities together. And it's incredibly meaningful, and they truly become a part of the family. It's not just on the side of the international groups either. It's the home hosts. I mean, there's a lot of tears at the airport, right, when they leave. That's for sure.
And it's interesting. We have to remember here in the United States that we have Hollywood, and Hollywood colors the perceptions of people all around the world. There wouldn't be a country that Hollywood wouldn't reach. And having lived more than a decade abroad myself, I know that you run into people who are full of the perceptions produced by Hollywood. Now, they can be flattering, but they can also be otherwise. Right?
Exactly.
So it's these personal relationships through the sister states that,
yes,
that set people right as to what are what's really happening. What is it really like to go to school in, mm-hmm, Iowa? What are the, mm-hmm, what are neighborhoods in Iowa, right, mm-hmm, like, Kim?
And the inside of houses, just to see a variety of different houses, the land size, you know, just the space that's available. Mm. The warmness, you know, oftentimes people come and about 3 days in, they realize that I'm not posing people on the sidewalks to greet them, because the smiles and whatnot that they get from Iowans, it's hard for them to believe, because they've got the perception that Americans are cold. Or even going into the state capitol, our legislators are very good about talking about the citizen legislature and that the capitol is open to all. And this is absolutely mind-blowing, because closing off government to their people is something that a lot of the countries they come from is what they experience. And so walking into a state capitol and getting to take pictures and having this FaceTime with a legislator who is a citizen legislator is unheard of. It's so incredibly important to them.
One of our listeners, who is named Kimberly, writes on our Facebook page, I was involved in a sister state exchange trip with Yamanashi, if that's correct.
Yes.
The prefecture back in 1999 when I was 18. I went on to get my MA in Japanese. And with all sister state programs, I like to see scholarship opportunities. So that fits, mm-hmm, in there too as well, huh, Kim?
Absolutely. And we have a scholarship relationship with Yamanashi still that she was talking about, where one Iowa student goes to Yamanashi for about 9 months and studies there. In fact, three of our most recent students are actually ended up going back to Japan to work since they've completed the program. But we also have a reciprocal program here, where we have two students from Yamanashi that attend DMAC for one semester.
Mm-hmm. So in ending here, Kim, tell us, how can people find out more about the Iowa Sister States organization and that opportunity, as you said, sort of going abroad without ever leaving Iowa?
Mm-hmm. Visit our website, www.iowasisterstates.org. That's a great way to just see the various programs we have going on. We try to keep it up to date. Again, we are very busy. We have lots going on right now, but we do put as much information on there as possible. There's email addresses for both myself and Hannah Borgi, who is our program manager, and then even contact us so that we can get out into the community. We want to talk to your clubs. We want to visit you. We are a statewide organization. So the more we are invited to get out into the statewide community, the better for us. And we just ask that the volunteers keep talking about us, keep visiting us and hosting people.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us. Kim Heidemann, Deputy Director of Iowa Sister States. Also, a big thanks to Sergeant Major David Enright and Major Mike Wan of the Iowa National Guard. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Do either of you have plans of going to Kosovo in the near future?
Yeah, I will be going.
And this is to identify?
This is Major Mike Wan here.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be going over the 1st of July. General Orr is going to go over for a senior leader visit, and that's going to overlay with the sister states delegation will be there, and then, of course, the governor.
Okay. Safe travels, enjoyable travels. Thank you, Major Mike One and Sergeant Major David Enright of the Iowa National Guard. Again, Kim Heidemann, thank you very much, Deputy Director of the Iowa Sister States organization. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton in Des Moines. Thanks go out to John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.